Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you here this evening to the annual chaplaincy lecture here at Heriot Watt. My name is Alistair Donald, and I'm the university chaplain. The annual chaplaincy lecture has been a feature of the public life of Heriot Watt for many years now. It's intended to be a navigation aid through the sometimes choppy waters that swirl between science, philosophy, and theology. It attracts both students and staff, as well as colleagues from other institutions, and as you can see looking around, members of the public from the local community and further afield. Just a few weeks after last year's lecture, we were sorry to learn of the death of my predecessor as chaplain, Reverend Howard Taylor, whom some of you may have known. The growing reputation of the chaplaincy lecture was in no small measure due to Howard's efforts. And friends may wish to be aware that his widow, Eleanor, has recently returned to live in Edinburgh. Now, before we begin, a couple of things. First of all, this evening will be recorded on audio, and CDs will be available for a small charge afterwards. Just email into myself at the chaplaincy. And then finally, the fire alarm will sound. If it sounds, it's not a practice. It's got a two-tone, which I'm told is called a yodel in technical speak. So if you hear a yodeling electronic thing, then please go to the nearest fire exit. They are there or at the back or here. So there you go. Well, with those formalities attended to, we can now proceed to our main business. And it gives me pleasure now to call upon Professor Alan Miller, Deputy Principal of the University, to introduce our speaker for this evening. Professor Miller.
Well, I'm very glad to extend my own welcome to you this evening to Heriot Watt University, and indeed wonderful to see such a wonderful, great turnout this evening, and that's, I think, all credit to our speaker this evening. So it's my privilege and pleasure now to introduce you to the speaker. Professor Wright is currently research professor at the University of St Andrews and a former Bishop of Durham, one of the highest positions of leadership in the Church of England. He is a globally renowned scholar and historian, and also a well-known author and broadcaster who has reflected deeply on the relation of belief to global culture. Tom, as he's known to his more in his more popular writings, is a native of Northumberland who studied classics at Oxford before training for the Christian ministry. He holds a Doctor of Divinity from Oxford University in addition to several honorary doctorates. He is an active member of several scholarly societies and still finds time to maintain his lifelong interest in music and sport. Early on in his varied career, he rejected the commonly held view that he would have to choose between specialising in either scholarship or pastoral care. He has himself amply bridged the apparent chasm between the two. As a scholar, he is as much a historian as a theologian, having won wide respect for his work on the historical context of the New Testament writings, as well as on the texts themselves. As a popular writer, he has published dozens of titles which have proved hugely beneficial to many. In his media appearances, he has devised and presented a number of radio and television programmes for the BBC and acted as consultant for many others. But Professor Wright's interests are by no means confined to the church. He has also contributed to robust discussion of moral, ethical, and political issues in the public square. He is particularly critical of the Enlightenment insistence on a rigid separation of the sacred and the secular, and he regards what he terms the secular utopianism of much modern culture is quite misplaced. Yet at the same time, his keen interest in macroeconomics and globalization has led him to argue that the West in general, and America in particular, have been exercising a form of economic and political imperial power. So his position is rather hard to classify. He's very much his own man. So these various issues are clearly of concern to us all, whatever our own beliefs and perspectives may be. So I'm sure that we're in for a stimulating lecture and no doubt a vigorous discussion afterwards. Tom, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you this evening to Heriot Watt University, and we look forward to what you have to say to us on the topic, Speaking of God in a Confused World.
Thank you very much for your kind words, for your welcome, for the invitation. It's an honour and a privilege to be here and to take part in this remarkable series and to have a chance this evening to address some issues which, though they are perennial, seem to come at us with renewed force in today's world. Let me say up front that the danger in my chosen title is that I might appear to be accusing the world in general of confusion while claiming that once we bring God into the equation, everything will become crystal clear. That would be a nice fantasy, but it wouldn't correspond to reality. The churches have contributed their fair share to the ongoing confusions of our day. Indeed, listening to my own CV just now, I seem to have done my own fair share of confusion. The idea that what Christians mean by God somehow injects clarity into confusion is itself part of the problem. One of the reasons it's hard to speak of God at all in the Western world today, outside the carefully closed doors of the church, is that the regular perception of God is significantly different from what the Christian tradition has meant by that word. The word God is a lumpy little syllable in English, like Gott in German. And I think even its verbal form has something to do with the bad press God has had in our culture. The Greek theos is gentler and more poetic. The Hebrew Elohim is positively mysterious. This may seem irrelevant, but I think it contributes to the mood which is invoked when people use the word. I asked myself as I was writing that, would it help if we all spoke Gaelic? Perhaps I had to look up what, I confess, what God in Gaelic is. It's Giu, though it doesn't look like that when you spell it on the page. I like informing foreigners that one of the mountains which I remember climbing as a boy is Ben Vain in the Cairngorms. And Vain is, of course, as you know, spelt M-H-E-A-D-H-O-I-N. but then I live near a village which is called Kinuka, though it's spelt Kilconquer. So, I mean, where are you? So, anyway, the blunt monosyllable God all too easily gives a double wrong impression. First, that God is an object within our world which can be named and discussed as such. And second, that such a being is a monolithic little dictator who sits there giving orders. Of course, the word doesn't itself suggest that, but granted that's how our culture likes to see God, then the blunt, clunky sound of the word easily goes with that popular image of God as a bully in the sky, who makes odd demands and becomes dangerously petulant if people ignore him. As, of course, they've been doing in increasing numbers over the last many years, so that those of us who don't see things like this find ourselves increasingly regarded as oddities. Not so long ago, if somebody walked into a room wearing a clerical collar, people would mind their manners and apologize if they use bad language. But now, the very present... Yeah, I know, it's funny to think of it now, but... But now the very presence of a dog collar in a train carriage or whatever can make people feel a bit uneasy, as though we clergy belonged to a different species. And if one of this strange tribe then brings this dangerous word God into conversation about politics or economics or farming or climate change or whatever it might be, then people start to shift uncomfortably in their seats. And since many of us clergy are, in fact, quite sociable creatures and like getting on with people, we are tempted not to use the G word at all, since we want to get on with folk and not drop social bricks all the time. So these common confusions thus dog our steps as we make our way into what most people think of as the real world. But there, however, on anyone's analysis, things are in any case in considerable confusion just now. Let me highlight a few of these ways, somewhat tendentiously, as is inevitable in a short presentation, before suggesting some underlying analyses. You don't need me to tell you that even our shiny modern Western world has been in a great state of confusion since the turn of this century and, of course, before. The roof fell in on our proud financial institutions 6 years ago, not only causing chaos, but leading to ongoing revelations about the appalling behaviour of the banks. I wrote that before I realised just how closely proximate you were to a certain well-known institution up the road. But nobody seems to know how to put it right. Bankers are still paying themselves enormous bonuses, and if customers dare ask where all that money comes from, I don't think we get good answers. I was in the House of Lords for the debate on this in December 2008, and I was appalled to find that everybody else was simply concerned with how to shore up the system and get it going again, and I was the only speaker out of 35 or 40 people even to mention the effect of all this on the poorest of the poor, here and elsewhere. That was the other shocking revelation, that governments suddenly bailed out rogue institutions to the tune of billions, whereas the mounting unjust and unpayable third world debt had been largely left untouched. The very rich did for the very rich what they had refused to do and still largely refused to do for the very poor. And the politicians didn't seem to know what to do about it. And that's the second area of confusion. Our present democratic institutions have encouraged a breed of career politicians, most of whom have never run a business or a prison or a bookshop or any such thing, and who are kept in place by mechanisms loosely designed in very different eras. The corruption scandals of MPs' expenses, the ease with which patronage systems build up, has led to public disaffection and low turnouts at the polls. A majority of seats are more or less safe, the present equivalent of the old rotten boroughs. And often ironically, and I say this having now given up my seat there, the House of Lords is the only place where genuine, independent, well-informed debate can go on, which is perhaps why some want to change it. We all believe in democracy, but we all know, if we're honest, that in its present form, and I'm thinking of other European countries and North America as well, in its present form, it doesn't work very well. As one of my friends in America said to me when they were coming up to a Senate election, the trouble is whoever you vote for, you're voting for a millionaire, and that cannot actually be healthy for the country at large. Now, all of this very loose, broad brush stuff has been compounded by the media scandals, phone hacking and worse. The idea that corrupt practices were the work of one or two isolated individuals, which people said at the beginning, now seems laughable. I suspect that many in the business who are not at present under scrutiny are shivering in their shoes as we await more revelations. This has made nonsense of the normal media plea that for democracy to work, you need a free press. That is, of course, basically true, but as in every other sphere, when freedom turns to self-serving license, everything goes bad. And many sections of the media continue to pontificate about it all as if it were not now an almost universal disease. Fourth element, now causing confusion, is the alarming evidence of corruption within the police force. As with all other institutions, there are, of course, plenty of good police, just as there are good bankers and politicians and journalists. But the smell of rottenness gets in the public's nostrils and makes nuanced judgment difficult. And when we put all these together and find the politicians being over-friendly with the bankers and indeed with the police sometimes, and them doing deals in different directions, there is a sense that as a society we are blundering around in a fog, engaging in displacement activities and eye-catching initiatives which do nothing for the general well-being, let alone allay the increasing confusion. We could multiply the list of public confusions, but the last one I'll mention is foreign policy in general. The UK has always had an uneasy relationship to Europe. That's nothing new, and that obviously continues. But that's just the start. Many of us believed, and said so at the time, that it was wrong on all counts 11 years ago to invade Iraq, and that such action would merely serve to increase al-Qaeda recruitment and general chaos. The trouble is, we don't know what else to do. The Arab Spring demonstrated that Western governments and journalists still cherish with touching naivety the belief that all people in all societies are really liberal Western Democrats at heart, and that all we have to do is help them get rid of their present tyrants, and then peace and love and flower power will automatically spring up in their place, giving stability and prosperity to all. And by sending that signal in relation to the countries of North Africa, we sent exactly the wrong message to the first wave of rebels in Syria, and we now have no idea what to do about the hornet's nest that has resulted, not to mention the appalling ongoing situation in Israel-Palestine or the chaos in many parts of Africa. And the optimism of the early years of the present century, when the then Prime Minister thought he could deal with evil by helping our friends across the Atlantic to drop bombs here and there, have been replaced by an uneasy and often unprincipled pragmatism. Now, this last area may lead some to comment, not without justification, that that's a bit rich coming from someone who wears a religious label. After all, are not most of the trouble spots in the world places where it's precisely religious clashes that have started or fueled riots and mayhem? Well, yes, in a sense it is. But the real problem lies deeper. Professor John Bowker argued a generation ago that the problem then was that none of our politicians had read religious studies at university, so they had no idea what was actually going on. They had bought into the modernist myth, according to which religion was what some human beings liked to do with their solitude, and that it had nothing to do with public life or policy, and bringing it in there was a category mistake. But we who live in the shadow of September the 11th, 2001, know only too well that the theory has been rudely interrupted by events. And if your reasoning doesn't factor in a healthy understanding of how religion works in the world, don't be surprised if it comes back and attacks you in unhealthy forms. That is, of course, where some commentators of the Richard Dawkins variety have seized on events like 9/11 as the evidence that all God talk is inherently wicked, disproved, bad for your health, and generally abhorrent. Granted that the good Professor Dawkins does indeed protest a bit too much, there is a prima facie case to be made, which people like me need to pay attention to. Why on earth make confusion worse confounded by dragging God into all these discussions? The answer cannot simply be because if people believed in God, they'd all behave better. That might be the case, but sadly it might not. As a bishop, I retain a certain scepticism on precisely that point. But what I've tried to do so far is to point out that at almost every point in our lives, we have run into serious problems, resulting in the cynical sense that the things we all have to trust do not deserve that trust. We seem to be making it up as we go along, with the only motive, that of making more money on one side or clinging to whatever power we can on the other, even though we don't know what to do with power once we've got it. And if it's true that millions have been killed in the last century or two for self-styled religious motives, it is also obviously the case that in the last two centuries, tens of millions, perhaps more, have been killed by avowedly secularist movements of one sort or another. So how have we got to where we've got? The key issues are the deeper structural problems and major shifts in cultural perceptions, and this was mentioned in the introduction. Some of this, of course, begins right here in Scotland, in the land of David Hume and Adam Smith. Welcome to the ambiguous world of the Enlightenment. Around the middle of the 18th century, a major shift took place in how many leading thinkers in Europe and America saw themselves and the world and the human project in general. Historians have mapped out the different branches of the Enlightenment, the German, French, American, and British varieties, and there are significant differences here between England and Scotland. But there is a major feature in common which must be named and explored. The reason the movement called itself the Enlightenment is surely clear. It's a story, a narrative, of how up to that point the human race had lived in ignorance and superstition, and how the new scientific and technical advances had resulted in a giant step forward for the human race as a whole. Humankind had come of age. It was a new saeculum. The Americans even put that phrase on their dollar bills, Novus Ordo Seclorum. It's actually a quote from Virgil, and it's there still. A new world order had come into being in which the ancient ills would be healed and a new type of civilization would replace the wicked ways of the past. These grand ambitions appear most obviously in science and technology. If I am ever accused, as I sometimes am, of being anti-Enlightenment, my now normal response is that I'm all in favour of modernism when I go to the dentist. I do not want to be operated on by a pre-modern dentist, or for that matter, a post-modern one. Think about it. I want the very best of high modern technology, thank you very much. And let that stand as a symbol, as metonymy, for all the enormous blessings which the scientific and technological advances of the last 200 or 300 years have brought us. But the Enlightenment project uses those claims as a platform to launch different claims, and indeed quite a different philosophy. And those claims and that philosophy remain at the heart of much present confusion. Here again, I risk oversimplification. Why change the habit of a lifetime? But for the sake of time, let me just summarize my two main points. First, the claim of a new world order is routinely applied many times each day in the media to the idea of moral progress. Now that we live in the modern world, a presenter will say, or perhaps now that we live in the 21st century, I suspect if you listened to various radio stations, you would hear that at least 10 times a day, whichever station it was. As though a change in the calendar automatically implied that we were all signed up to a relentless program of continual liberalization of values and standards. And any attempt to stem this modernist tide is met with ridiculous abuse. People used to say that the classic values of Western civilization were medieval. Now, it's notched up a bit. Any such attempts at restatement, we are told, are returning to Stone Age morality. How far back can you go? David Cameron, speaking in the House of Commons in November 2013, said that the Church of England should get with the program, implying that we all knew which direction society ought to be moving in and that the Church had just better come into line. Hillary Clinton spoke of being on the wrong side of history, as though we all knew automatically which direction history was travelling in. That was another Arab Spring faux pas. And so on. Let's say it clearly. This rhetoric, instantiating a kind of irresistible Whig version of moral and social history, is a matter of air. It is hot air based on thin air, leaving us in mid-air. And second, this narrative explicitly and deliberately embraces the ancient philosophy known as Epicureanism. This philosophy has been making a comeback since the rediscovery of Lucretius in 1417, but the events of the 16th and 17th century created conditions for a sudden new flourishing. In Epicureanism, the gods may or may not exist, but they take no interest in the affairs of this world and certainly never intervene in it, so this world just keeps rolling along under its own steam. David Hume's rejection of miracles is basically Epicureanism applied. So is Adam Smith's invisible hand economics. Get intervention out of the way, stuff will just happen by itself. For Lucretius in the 1st century BC, the point was that the natural world, including human beings, evolves by itself without outside interference. And for the Enlightenment, the evidence for biological evolution reaching a rhetorical, though not a scientific, climax with Darwin's Origin of Species was hailed as the evidence for a very different view, namely that everything about life, including morals and politics, ought to work on the same principle. Now, all this had and still has long-term consequences which have created the conditions for today's confusions. First, there is a seemingly ineradicable public belief in what we loosely call progress. Progress, especially the 19th century versions emanating from Hegel and others, is basically a secular version of the ancient Jewish idea that history had a purpose and was going somewhere. The trouble is, if, as in Epicureanism, you take God or the gods out of the equation, you divinize the ongoing movement of history, however random. And so strong is this belief that it can outlast the obvious counterexamples. Progress gave us aeroplanes. It also gave us the First World War. Progress gave us penicillin. It also gave us the Holocaust. Hence the classic postmodern protests of people like Walter Benjamin in Germany and François Lyotard in France. The big stories of progress have let us down. They were a failure. But we, our Western culture, still goes on, as if they were true. Now, the other side of that coin is another secularized Jewish belief, the belief in the possibility of a sudden messianic revolution through which everything will be made right. The idea of a non-theistic messianic moment was all that Walter Benjamin had left at the end of his life, and it didn't come. The Marxist version of this has suffered many setbacks in the last 30 years, but it still reappears whenever somebody suggests that if only we made this reform, if only we did this radical change, whatever it might be, then the utopia which we all know should have arrived by now would in fact break out at last. And of course, as with progress, so with revolution. When these fail, we are left with cynicism, pragmatism, and opportunism, which is pretty much where we are right now. Now, this rampant Epicureanism doesn't usually call itself that, because that would be to give the game away and admit that this is an ancient philosophy, not something that we just learned, clever us, in the 18th century. But it has produced two features of special importance. First, there is the transformation of science into scientism, and second, there is the rigorously non-theistic approach to politics and public life, including public morality. First, science and scientism. I take my life in my hands because I'm not a scientist, but some of my best friends are scientists. Can I say that? And tell me I'm wrong afterwards, please. Many, perhaps most, of the early Western scientists were either Christians or at least deists. They believed they were thinking God's thoughts after him. Likewise, many Christians, faced with the publication of Darwin's work, were perfectly happy to accept it. There is a modern myth in which a backward and belligerent church staunchly opposed all such dangerous innovations. That is truer in the early 20th century in America than it was in most of this country. Many theologians thought, well, if God wanted to create species over the course of millennia, why shouldn't he? What's the problem? But Darwin's findings were seized on not simply by biologists, but by those who wanted to promote the latent Epicureanism in which the gods had gone from the picture altogether. And people began to talk about science as though science itself contained or proved that philosophy. This is, of course, not the case. Science, as I understand it, does excellently well in its own sphere, but it cannot and should not pronounce on issues like values and ethics, history and faith, aesthetics and eschatology. The former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, one of, in my view, the greatest commentators on the present scene that we've had for many years, puts it like this in his recent book: science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. Let me say that again. It's his wonderful bon mot, not mine. Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. They need each other and should never have been separated. When that separation occurs, instead of science, you get scientism, which actually is a belief that nobody can live their whole life by. The belief that science and technology contain all answers to all questions. Having banished the gods up into the sky, this is to invite new divinities to emerge from the floor. And second, this happens, of course, in politics. Alistair Campbell famously said in the Tony Blair years that Downing Street doesn't do God. There was a point to that, of course. He wanted to ward off any suggestion that foreign policy was being conducted by the Prime Minister receiving fresh divine instructions, as he said his prayers every night. But the relentless rejection of God in public life, despite both England and Scotland still having their own established churches, is based on the same Epicureanism I've described. The democratic process, like biological evolution, must proceed on its way. And what comes out next must be for the best. Except, of course, that it often isn't. The media hold the politician's feet to the fire so that any politician who actually told the truth, namely, that whatever reforms we put in place will not produce utopia, and that it's better to try to minimize disaster and work for the least worst options, anyone who actually said that would be laughed out of court. In America, where God is still invoked on many occasions, the rigorous 18th century split of church and state is eagerly applied both by politicians who don't want God to rain on their picnics and by religious leaders who suppose politics to be unspiritual. And the churches on both sides of the Atlantic actually have colluded with the Enlightenment project, being content to provide the spiritual dimension, not realizing that a central part of Christian belief is about God's kingdom coming on earth as in heaven, uncomfortable and confusing though that may be. But before we can explore that, one more final word about the present state of confusion in our modernist ideologies. We all know now that the modernist project has been critiqued from three angles in particular: Marx on money, Freud on sex, Nietzsche on power. But what has happened is a toxic mixture of continuing modernism and cynical postmodern deconstruction. We all know that money is at the heart of much corruption, but we can't seem to clear it up. We all know, and the current high-profile court cases are rubbing our noses in this, that the sexual liberation of the 60s seemed like good and exciting news to some, but came at a high price for others. We all now know, or we ought to, that there is no such thing as casual sex. We all know, likewise, that our Western peace and prosperity are like a small, placid island off the shore of a dangerous, turbulent continent, whether we look at Africa, the Middle East, Ukraine, wherever. We all know we have the disease, but we go on doing the things that made it worse. So, what would happen if we tried a fresh exploration of that clunky little word God in the middle of it all? How are we to interpret the signs of the times, given all that I've said? Mention of interpretation reminds me of a significant moment. In November 2004, the people of Ukraine were voting in a presidential election. Everyone suspected that foul play was going to take place. When the results were declared on national television, the announcer gave the expected news. The president had won by a large majority. But in the corner of the screen, visible to television viewers, there was a woman who was signing for the deaf. She went completely off message, and instead of translating the result, she signed, "We all know that this election was rigged, it's all a sham, and it's time we rebelled." So the Orange Revolution began because someone had the courage to tell the true story against the grain of the prevailing myth. great picture. Now, of course, Ukraine isn't out of trouble yet, not by any means. But that image of someone apparently translating but actually subverting is a powerful image for what I want to suggest. Now, I speak, of course, as one who believes that it is right and necessary to speak of God within this confused world, while recognizing fully the difficulties of doing so. And I envisage this task and vocation, not least in terms of trying to communicate, like that brave Ukrainian signer, the subversive message that things are not all they seem and that there is a different way. We share with the postmodernists the deep suspicion of the arrogant claims of modernity, but instead of that leading to cynicism, pragmatism, and opportunism, we see it, we Christians see it, as an opportunity to articulate, and equally importantly to try to live out, a different vision of what it means to be human, a vision which stems directly from the different vision of God himself, which the Jewish and Christian traditions uphold, and to which the Christian tradition in particular has given a special spin. As some at least today come to recognize the bankruptcy of positivism and pseudo-scientific reductionism, there's been some remarkable work done by philosophers in that area just recently, this word may perhaps gain a fresh hearing. Let's say it clearly up front. The God of whom Jews and Christians speak has very little in common with the God of popular imagination, certainly with the absent divinities of the prevailing Epicureanism. Though we continue to use this clunky little monosyllable when we talk about him, when Christians speak of God, they speak of the one whom Jesus taught us to call Father. And the life and death and resurrection of Jesus have so radically reordered, reshaped the meaning of the word God that there are quite different things to be said, in private and public, than what our contemporary culture normally imagines. For a start, the God whom Christians worship is not an object within our world. Rather, we are creatures within his world. The relationship is bound to be asymmetrical. To speak of this God as creator is in no way undermined by the discovery that the natural world is a place of gradual development. That would be somewhat like suggesting that because we now understand how a piano works, there is no need to postulate the existence of Mozart or Beethoven. But when we think of God as the creator of all that is, however difficult an idea that is to hold in our heads, which is why people produce simplistic caricatures, we realize that our world as a whole has been worshipping other gods. Without naming them as such, we have in fact been worshipping Mammon, the god of money, Aphrodite, the goddess of erotic love, not least Mars, the powerful war god. He'll get the job done. Go and drop some bombs on people, then all will be well. That is Mars speaking. And we have offered these gods sacrifices because they've demanded them, and many of which have been and continue to be human sacrifices. Because whether we call these divinities gods or not, whether we even realize we're worshipping them or not, it is our absolute allegiance to them, coupled with the intellectual Epicureanism which allows us to ignore them, that lies near the root of much of our confusion. And in the ancient pagan world, the message put out by Jews and Christians alike that there is a single divine being who made the world, who loves the world, and who desires to set it right and so is calling it to account, this message was good news. Many responded to its clarity, its clean lines, its brisk, straightforward challenge. And those who are battered and confused in today's world might well do the same. But of course, the Christian message in particular doesn't stop there. One might simply say, well, that's a nice idea, but we have no particular reason for supposing it's true. We better just muddle on as before. But the Christian way of speaking about God goes much further. It focuses particularly on Jesus of Nazareth, his short public career, and his death and resurrection. In other words, this isn't an idea, a belief without an anchor. This is about something that actually happened, something which those closest to the events believed had transformed the way the world was, something which brought the word God into such sharp and startling focus that when the early Christians said the word theos in Greek and interpreted it in the light of Jesus, it opened up to reveal a wisdom and purpose, a power and a love which began to transform them and through them began to transform the world. I said a moment ago that in Christian language, God isn't an object in our world. But here's the important exception, that in Jesus, this God became a subject within our world. He has become an actor in our drama. He has stepped in to play the solo in what we thought was our symphony, but which turns out to be his concerto. Now, naturally, many people have challenged the historical basis of the Christian claim. The very existence of Jesus himself is sometimes doubted, though not by any serious historians. To be sure, there are different possible interpretations of detail. I've set out the case elsewhere for the substantial accuracy of the early Christian accounts as the only possible historical basis for understanding how the first century worked. And what I want to do now is to show how this might begin to work out in the confused world in which we live. For a start, we should remind ourselves that from the beginning, the Christian message about this strange, unexpected God was, as St. Paul put it, foolishness to the Greeks. It isn't the case that people found it easy to believe in the ancient world and that we find it hard to believe in the modern world because we now know the laws of nature or something. As C.S. Lewis once put it, delicately, the reason St. Joseph was worried about Mary's pregnancy was not because he didn't know where babies came from, but because he did. The Christian vision of God has always been earth-shattering. It doesn't fit into the neat categories provided by other systems, whether ancient or modern. And this is, after all, what you'd expect. If there really is a God like this, you wouldn't expect to put the wind of his power and love into the small bottles of other worldviews. Now, of course, that could just be an excuse for talking nonsense. No, you wouldn't understand it, so I'll just go on rabbiting on about it and that'll be all right. No, it's not like that. There are strong safeguards against going down that road. There is Jesus himself, both the figure of history and the figure who remains surprisingly contemporary, the figure whom millions around the world claim in some sense to know as a powerful and present personal reality. Jesus stood in the middle of the thoroughly confusing world of his day. We think ours is confusing. His was a nightmare. With its different currents of power politics, protest movements, competing philosophical and religious teachings. And Jesus announced in deed as much as in word that there was a different way to do things and that the world was being reordered to make that a reality. It was a way he called the kingdom of God. And he kept redefining that phrase through strange stories and powerful actions in such a way that it gained new layers of meaning, never more than through his eventual death and resurrection. It meant that the one true God, Israel's God, the world's creator, was now taking charge in quite a new way, opening up a vision for the renewal of the whole creation. A renewal which would begin with his own followers, but quickly spread beyond them. This was essentially the ancient Jewish vision, but now opened up to include all. In this vision, and here's the big difference between that meaning of God and the public one we have today, in that vision, the God who made the world intended from the start to run it through human beings. That's part of what it means to say that humans are made in God's image, to reflect his wise stewardship into his world. So instead of God as absolute dictator, handing down decrees and hurling thunderbolts at those who disobey, we find God sharing power with his human creatures. God wants the world to be run wisely and so calls and equips humans with the skills to do it. That's the theory, but of course humans decide to do it their own way. So what does God do? Here's the mystery. He creates a people, Israel, to bear his promise of rescue and renewal for the world. And when this people themselves fail, he comes himself as the representative of Israel to do for Israel and the world what they couldn't do for themselves. Here is the heart of the Christian message about the true God, that in Jesus, Israel's Messiah, this living God has launched a new project, a new way of being human, a new way of looking after the world and bringing it to peace and justice and fulfillment. What did it mean to speak of this God within the confusions of the ancient world? For a start, it meant persecution. The Roman Empire did not like this message at all and did its best to stamp it out. So why did the message spread? There are two complementary answers. At one level, you could say it spread because, quite simply, it worked. This new way of being human was not just revolutionary, it was attractive, particularly to the people at the bottom of the pile. The early Christians were known particularly for their care of the poor, and they became known for looking after the sick, not just their own, but others. They worked tirelessly and cheerfully to put into practice the project of new creation, which they believed Jesus had launched. And when in that context they spoke about this strange new God, it made a whole lot of sense to people. And this points to the second answer. They all said this new life was possible because the spirit of this God, his own personal and powerful presence, initiated it and sustained it. This God clearly wasn't a matter of intellectual speculation, first and foremost. He made a difference. Those who named him and worshipped him and claimed to act in his name had a bold and cheerful and subversive agenda, and they went at it even if it cost them their lives. This is what I mean when I say that the Christian good news was at one level foolishness, but at another level it appeared as wisdom and indeed as power. The world has always been full of confusions and puzzles and about justice and freedom and beauty and wisdom and spirituality and love. We all know these are good things, we all want them, but they slip through our fingers. We grasp at them and we can't hold on. And if someone says, here is a new God revealed in a young man being brutally lynched and then being raised from the dead, we're inclined to say, look, just don't talk nonsense. Things are quite bad enough as they are without introducing that kind of craziness. But when the followers of this crucified young man start to live in a way which exemplifies justice and freedom and beauty and wisdom and spirituality and love of a sort which is compelling and attractive, suddenly the message doesn't look like nonsense after all. There seems to be a new power at work. Speaking of God in a confused world will make sense if and only if those who do the speaking are doing the Jesus stuff, making things happen in a way that gives body to their claims. So how might this work out in our world as described before? A few pointers as I work towards my conclusion. One of the striking things done by the new Archbishop of Canterbury, you'll have read this in the press, was to confront the payday lenders' wonga and to challenge them to a test of strength in which the church would start doing credit unions which would actually help the poor instead of fleecing them. Of course, he was then put offside by his own team because the church had invested in the same shabby business without him knowing it. That, I think, is being sorted out. The point was that the church at its best doesn't just sit on the sidelines giving intellectual arguments about God and then saying God doesn't like what you're doing. The church believes in and speaks about a God who rolls up his sleeves and gets his hands dirty to sort things out. I was privileged when I worked in Durham to see that going on in poor communities again and again. There are plenty of people in places like that who know that however confused the world is, speaking of God does make a lot of actual sense. I wonder what it would look like to do the same in the area of sexual behavior. Faced with more and more cases where people thought they could give up the older morality and live in the modern world, only to bring emotional chaos to many vulnerable people, it makes sense to speak of God as the creator as the one in whom all our loves and desires are centered and refocused. That's again hard because the church has tragically shared in the same bad behavior, but it needs to be done. We in our generation ought to know the damage caused by the opposite belief. And when it comes to power, money, sex, and power, you see, and again, the church hasn't always handled this well, there is a particular vocation to speak for God in the councils of the world. From the time when Jesus confronted Pontius Pilate and argued about kingdom, truth, and power, his followers have had the vocation to speak the truth to power. That's never been popular. And it's particularly unpopular now with the media because the media think it's their job to speak the truth to power and they don't like the church claiming that turf back again. But it will include, if we're going to do it, mastering the complex briefs of the day, not just flailing around like I tend to do, but you know, people need to get out there and know what they're talking about and then have the courage to speak for creation and justice and life and wisdom. In and through all of this, then, what sense does it make to speak of God himself? As I've said, I haven't talked about God in the abstract, but rather the God who gets involved in the actual world. That's a danger. We've allowed God to be abstracted so that he only becomes the conversation about philosophy and leading to cheap denials on the one hand and a kind of abstract, decontextualized apologetic on the other. But part of the answer comes in the communities who are not only speaking of God, but living for God. There is always room for fresh exposition of who God is, as it were, in himself. The difficulty is that all our discourse must be related properly to the true subject matter. It's as though you don't describe a Sibelius symphony in the same language you use for a theory in economics. So what is the language appropriate for God? It's all too easy to talk about God again as if he were an object in our world, to be studied and analyzed and inquired after and coolly appraised and either intellectually affirmed or intellectually denied. That would not only be an epistemological mistake, the use of the wrong technique, it might actually be dangerous, like trying to examine sunspots by looking at them through the same powerful telescope you use for a distant star. And that's why the primary language in relation to God has always naturally been invocation and worship. This is not a private activity only, a hobby for the religiously minded. If the word God has any referent at all, then worship is bound to be the appropriate first word. But then, because of who Christians claim the true God really is, we cannot but speak of him, as it were, outside church, in the confused world of our own day. We urgently need not just an apologia, a nervous explanation for why it might still be all right to speak about God. We need the powerful words which declare that the true God has unveiled a different way of being human, a way which sums up all our hopes but transforms and transcends them. In particular, and finally, we need always to remember that to speak truly of this God is to speak not just of power, but of love. If the God we see in Jesus is the one true God, then this picture radically deconstructs the negative image God has so often been given in the modern world, as indeed in the ancient one. The famous verse in St. John's Gospel does not say God so hated the world that he sent Jesus, but God so loved the world. And that love translates into justice for this occasion, into peacemaking for that occasion, into help for the poor always and everywhere, into the rescue and repair of relationships at every level, into the invitation to a life of prayer and wisdom and spirituality and inner healing. That love is what those who speak of God must never stop showing and living and telling. The problem of a malevolent and distant God was solved by the Enlightenment in terms of banishing such a being from the scene entirely. We have seen the results of that false move. It's time to solve it the other way, by realizing that the true God is neither malevolent nor distant. In and through Jesus, we know him to be the way, the truth, and the life. The Enlightenment leaves us alone in the world and often enough isolated from one another. With the true God, there is a multiple sense of belonging to God himself and to one another. In and through the Spirit of Jesus, we may gain fresh wisdom to address our confused world, not just with a theory about the one God, but with the good news of his powerful, rescuing love. Thank you very much.
Now, we do have some time for questions, and there's at least one roving mic. Is there more than one? Two roving mics. So, are you content to do your own thing?
Yep,
yes.
Sure.
And there's the two people there, so if you would put your hand up, please, the mic will find you, and then you can ask your question, and Professor Wright will reply.
Professor Wright, I think I speak for everyone, just thank you for your talk tonight, and I do have to say also personally, I'm a great admirer of your work, and I am looking forward to reading your magnum opus, which I have seen. But what I wanted to ask about was, it seems like in a lot of your thought and recent thinking, and even in particular the little bit on Revelation, and your thinking on Revelation, is that there is brewing a great interest in political theology and actually drastically changing how we think of the church's relationship to the state. And I would just wonder who in particular are you thinking about when you're thinking about political issues or in terms of a political theology in your thought?
It's a good question because I read a variety of people and I find myself agreeing with some people sometimes and then not in other times. I'm a very old friend of Professor Oliver O'Donovan, who used to teach here in Edinburgh and before that in Oxford and has just retired. And probably two-thirds of what he says, I think, yes, absolutely. And then we go on arguing about the other one-third. That's what friends are for. The big thing I would say is this, that since the French Revolution, in Europe and North America, we've tended to do politics on a left-right axis. We all sort of think of a spectrum with chaos at the left end and tyranny at the right end, and we all decide where we want to be on. So you can talk about people being centre-right or centre-left or whatever. And then when you look at the New Testament, people often say, well, there's Paul says the powers that be are ordained by God. So obviously he's out on the centre-right somewhere. He's in favour of the status quo. Then you read other things by Paul where it seems to me blindingly obvious that he means if Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not Lord, and go figure. And that puts him way out on the left. And the answer is our spectrums do not map onto the way they thought about the world, the powers, governments, in their day. In particular, both the ancient Jews and the early Christians didn't bother very much about how rulers became rulers. That's become the thing for us because our democratic process, note that word process, is so bound up with post-Enlightenment, get rid of God, and it must all happen in process, that all that matters for us is if somebody's come through a democratic process, then we assume that whatever they do for the next 4 or 5 years must be right. The ancient world, they didn't think like that at all. Rulers became rulers for all sorts of reasons. The important thing was then to hold a mirror to power and say, actually, you're getting it wrong. And of course, the ancient Greeks and Romans often used to put their rulers on trial after their period in office. Wouldn't that be a nice innovation? you know, there's also, so, I mean, I really just sort of want to joggle it up a bit and say, let's actually try and listen to what the early texts are saying, both Jewish and Christian, but not by forcing them straight into our spectrums, which are actually rather shallow, and then it's confusing because America doesn't have the same spectrum as Europe does, et cetera, but it is all on the left-right thing. Let's try and learn a more multi-layered, multi-dimensional wisdom about society. And when we do that, then whether you call it religion, God, whatever, is going to be there because that's part of real life and it has to be factored in. Otherwise, as we've discovered, you get disaster. Great question to start with. Let's have some more. There's one two-thirds of the way back. Yeah, the gentleman in the... Yeah.
Professor Wright, we do often hear a different word being used for God in our multicultural society. We're normally hearing the term on our televisions, God is great, not God is love. And we're hearing it obviously in Arabic. And that's part of the cultural baggage that we're living with. I wonder what your thoughts are on speaking about the God of love when in the background is a particular version of God that is utterly at variance with, I think, all that you've been talking about.
Yes, it's a tricky one because I'm not an expert on Islam. I have, however, twice done quite serious high-level Christian-Muslim discussions. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, twice invited me to join those, and we had in both those times a wonderful week each time, sitting down with Muslims from significantly different bits of the Muslim world, but looking at the Quran, looking at the Christian scriptures together, and I've done a little bit of the scriptural reasoning as well, where you have Christians, Muslims, and Jews doing that together. And of course, as with Jewish people, as with many Christian denominations, so with Muslims, the problem comes who speaks for the tradition as a whole. And that's difficult actually within the churches, globally and even nationally. It's particularly difficult in Islam, and there are many, many Muslims who, hearing me talk about a God of love, would say, that is the Allah that I worship. And they will then read Quran texts in such a way as to bring that flavor out. And it's a debate within Islam itself as to which variety, what you mean when you say Allahu Akbar, whatever, what you're actually going to mean by that and how it cashes out. So this isn't so much a matter of all Christians thinking this way and all Muslims thinking that way. However, of course, as is well known, and this is uncontroversial, the very center of the Christian faith is the idea of God becoming human and being crucified. And though Issa, the Arabic word for Jesus, is a prophet in the Quran, he certainly is not the divine incarnate Son of God, and he certainly did not die on a cross. And many theologians have traced that out in terms of larger Christian and Muslim structures, that what is most truly central and also most truly shocking about the Christian claim is that it reveals a different dimension to love, so that though many Muslims will say, of course, Allah is loving and merciful, this doesn't translate into a self-giving of the sort that we find in the New Testament. We have to be terribly, terribly careful about how we say this, because, as I say, many Muslims would say quite different things from many other Muslims, and it seems to me what we have to... I mean, okay, the New Testament was born into a world of many, many faiths, and they didn't go around saying everything that everyone believes is totally wrong. Paul said, my aim is to take every thought captive to obey the Messiah. And we can see him doing that. He picks up Stoic ideas. He picks up, of course, lots and lots and lots of the Jewish scriptures, and he translates it out. And so the Christian view is not that everyone else is wrong and we're totally right. Far from it. Because we believe in God the Creator. It would be astonishing if there were not all sorts of positive signs. Paul says, wherever there is virtue or good report or anything that's lovely or true, celebrate it. Think about these things. And I think if we're going to critique Islam theologically and sometimes practically and politically, we also need to celebrate all the very good and noble and true things which are there as well. This isn't easy. We love things to be either or, black, white, so that it makes it easy for us. Then we don't have to think. The real world is much more interesting, thank God, than that. There's a question up the back there. Yeah.
My reflection with Scotland here is that our national consciousness of God has been scarred by an overemphasis on the holiness of God through our Calvinist history. Obviously, God is a God of love, and we want to speak about God's love, but God is holy too. Any suggestions about how we communicate both the holiness of God and the love of God in a right biblical balance in our society today?
Yeah. Nice, easy little question. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the danger is that we slide into the caricature, and when we want to say that God is holy, we come down like a ton of bricks on everything that happens to offend us at the moment. And when we want to say God is love, we go all gooey and sentimental, and you know, God just becomes a doddery old grandfather who doesn't really mind what the kids get up to. And actually, when you see the New Testament definitions of holiness and love, they don't look like that at all. And something about God's holiness is to do with God as the good and wise creator who longs to see the whole creation rescued from everything that corrupts and decays and defaces and distorts it, and especially human beings in the middle. So that holiness is actually about the vision of a genuine human existence, throbbing with life and vitality and joy and just celebrating the goodness of God's world. You know, the psalmist says that God makes the outgoings of the morning and evening to praise him. And something about when you see a sunrise or a sunset, something about the whole creation just saying yes. And holiness is when you get that in a human being, a sort of sense that this person's whole being is saying yes to the goodness of God's, God as creator. And we have so often made it a person who says no to this and no to that. I remember a chap I knew many years ago saying to me sorrowfully, he was a chap who was working as a barman in the college where I was studying, and he said to me, suddenly blurted out one day, he said, "The trouble is everything Jesus is against, I like." And I thought, I know exactly what you mean, but let's try and rephrase that. You know, what is Jesus for? That's what it's about. And then love is seen again as God's utter delighted longing that the very, very best should happen to his world and to his human creatures. And love wants the best for the beloved and is not content with second best. So ultimately, love and holiness are signposts pointing in to the mystery which we see in Jesus. And of course, you know, every community has to work that out for itself. And communities swing this way and that and get twisted up and puzzled about things and need to be sorted out. It's a constant thing. There is no point, speaking as a pastor, there is no point where you can say, right, we've now got this thing sewn up, we can just coast for the next 5 or 10 years. That is never going to happen. Probably some clergy here, and you know as well as I do, that's just not how real communities work. But if we keep that vision before our eyes and are constantly working back towards it, it's a celebratory vision which encompasses love and holiness and beauty and justice and all those other things as well. I can see three questions now suddenly. One, two, three. So whichever the microphone gets to first. Oh, somebody right at the back. Okay, yes, and then, yes, go on.
From a moral perspective, do you think that with the decline in the acceptance of religion generally and the increase in the reliance on scientific conviction, that society's morality has decreased over the years where Christianity has dwindled somewhat, or has it merely continue to develop whilst leaving behind Christianity more than it has done previously?
That is one popular picture, but I actually think there's a lot of problems with it. I mean, yes, the positivism which went with a sort of scientism in the middle years of the 20th century did produce an emotivist ethic. That is to say that ethics is simply reduced to I happen to dislike murder, you happen to dislike theft. It's a sort of yaboo sort of morality where all moral judgments collapse back into individual feelings. Now, it seems to me at the same time, actually, what we saw in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, I'm old enough to remember that whole period, was a major moral outpouring of horror at apartheid in South Africa, at some of the evils of Eastern European communism, etc. And the world got together and said, very morally, that is not how to treat people. And finally, through some remarkable things in which the church had a very big hand, both of those situations changed drastically. Okay, South Africa is still in difficulties, Eastern Europe still has its problems, but so that we didn't become an amoral society, and we haven't become one now. I mean, the moralism of the whole climate change business is sometimes rather scary. I mean, I believe very firmly that we must be looking after the environment and must use all our energies to do that. that. But sometimes people who seem to have given up moralism in other spheres are leaning all the moral energy on this one. And that happens in other spheres as well. So we don't stop being moral. It's just we sometimes swing this way and that, and some causes suddenly become fashionable. And so everyone gets on that particular bandwagon. We need a more measured, wise, overall overlook at the whole thing. And for that, yes, it is. Is that about religion? Again, the danger of the word religion, it's a very complicated word, and we use it differently from how they used it in the ancient world. But it seems to me people need to learn again how to talk wisely about God without this funny little despot in the sky, and without morals being reduced to God says you shouldn't. You know, because morals are about something much bigger than, more powerful than that, about how to be wisely human within the complexities of a whole world. And that's something we need tradition, we need reflection, we need all sorts of things. And God is in the middle of that. Sorry, it's a rambling answer, but a huge and important question. There was a question in the front here, then one three rows behind at an angle, and then and there's somebody over there as well. Perhaps the other mic could make its way over to the middle over there. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I firstly thank you for this evening? My question relates to God sharing power with humans. You said that Jesus Christ lived in a time that was much more confusing than ours. He was the final revelation, you know, the exact imprint of God. I guess my question is really is, seeing that we're much further on, and we don't just live in a confused world, but the church is confused. Is there any way of addressing the confusion in the world without first addressing the confusion in the church?
Perfectly good question. And yes, as I hinted more than once, I am probably as much aware of confusions in the church as anyone in this room, having lived at the sharp end of that. However, the good news is that what one sees when one says the church, and this goes for church history as well, what one tends to see is a few church leaders, a synod that says this, a big document that says that. Actually, the real life of the church goes on way below the radar with ordinary communities in ordinary towns and cities and villages and streets doing the Christian thing, loving their neighbors. That's why in the second and third century, even when the Romans were trying to stamp Christianity out, that's why the movement spread, not because great theologians had big ideas. That was the kind of backup system, the scaffolding, but because of what ordinary people were doing at ordinary levels. And I say, one of the privileges of being a bishop was just to see that happening without people having a top-down teaching that said, now the bishop has said we've got to do this, this, and this, but I would go to parishes and find they were doing all sorts of things just because they were saying their prayers, they were looking out for their neighbours, and certain ideas seemed to suggest themselves for new projects, for schemes for playgroups for children in deprived areas, whatever it was. Stuff happens. And when that stuff happens, out of that matrix of prayerful care, of course, what's happened in our Western world is that since the 18th century, the state has picked up the social agenda, which it never had before. The church used to do education, healing, etc., at a time when no government thought it was its business. Now Western governments have cottoned on, think, hey, that's got to happen, that's a good idea. The problem then, as with the human rights thing, is, as Benedict said Pope Benedict said five or six years ago, if you take that agenda, which was a Christian agenda, but cut off its roots in the Christian revelation, you'll find it goes sour on you. And that's actually what's happening right now with some of our public services on both sides of the Atlantic. So the good news is that this stuff actually happens. But of course, yes, the church constantly has to be reminded to get its act together, because it's a scandal when the church is failing on the very things where it ought to be showing that there is a different way. Certainly. Yes, sir. The middle of this side, right by the end of the road. That, and then if the other mic could go back a few rows there, that's great. Thanks.
Having myself worked for a church not 10 miles away from here for many years, but not as a clergy, one of my conclusions is the church has a rather bad record when it has power. Would you say that God never intended followers of Jesus actually to have power in a kind of corporate sense? I mean, your vision for what you're expressing here about just doing it at grassroots level is I very much agree with you. But what do you do with it when it gets bigger?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge question, like all these questions are, and it relates not least to what happened in the 4th century when the Roman emperor discovered that half his empire had become Christian despite his best efforts to stamp them out. And so the church had to become legitimate, so it was going to be impossible to proceed otherwise. And then they said, okay, we need to work out how to do this together. And some people today are so horrified by the Constantinian settlement that they say that was, as it were, the fall of the church. The church should never have done this. And it seems to me that there's something ludicrous there, that if you've been persecuted for 250 years, and then the emperor comes to you and says, actually, you seem to be doing rather well, think we need to get into this power sharing together, you're not going to say, oh no, please go on persecuting us because that makes us so much more authentic. You know, you're probably going to say, oh my goodness, we hadn't expected this. How are we going to work this out? We're probably going to make some mistakes, but we have to say our prayers and give it a go. And yes, we have made lots and lots of mistakes, and we could probably all produce a litany of those mistakes. As I said, not nearly as many mistakes as governments make when they try and do the stuff without God, but still. So it's not so much power, and of course the word power itself is a bit of a dirty word in our world, which I think is naive, because actually I believe, this is part of creational monotheism, that God, as I said, wants humans to be wisely in charge of things. God doesn't want humans all to be little puppets or little random blobs running around. God actually wants wise humans to look after the world. That's part of being in the image of God. So the church is bound to be part of that to a lesser or greater extent, but the thing which is more important, I think, is the church learning again how to speak truth to power. And that's really difficult because we get it wrong. And that's why I said we need to have specialists who can actually master the brief and not just fire off salvos in a general direction. We need to work on the detail. But for that to happen, and that is there in the New Testament again and again, that when the Spirit comes, he will convict the world of sin and righteousness and judgment. How does the Spirit work? The Spirit works through human beings. So how are we to do that? Well, look at Jesus talking to Pontius Pilate in John 18 and 19. That's the beginning of Christian political theology. But it's not a power trip for Jesus. It ends up with him being crucified. Nevertheless, Pilate is called to account, and Jesus ends up as the Lord of the world. So, you know, there is always that paradox, and it's not something we can ever finally learn, put in our back pockets and say we never need to work at that again. Every generation has to work this one out for itself. One more question. Right. Yes, we were here. I'm sorry, there's only time for one more.
Is it important that the Church of England and the Church of Scotland remain established churches?
The obvious answer is yes and no. There was a huge hue and cry several generations ago when the church in Wales disestablished, and people are terribly, what's going to happen? The church in Wales is the church in Wales, the Anglican church in Wales. I'm not sure that it has been more or less successful, whatever success means for a church. It does seem to me at the moment that, well, two things really, and I should say, I'm sure you all know that the kind of establishment the Church of England has is different from the kind of establishment the Church of Scotland has. Both are different from the kind of establishment the Church in Sweden has. I was in Sweden last year. Very interesting to hear their discussions about this, which aren't quite the same as ours. However, in my experience, the pressure for disestablishment mostly comes, not all, but mostly comes from people who want to banish God from the public square entirely. And just to say, we are now a secular community and all that old religious nonsense can just go away in a corner and witter away to itself, thank you very much. So that for the churches to say, actually, it's time we disestablished, would be in severe danger of colluding with secularism at the very point when secularism itself is running out of steam. And that seems to me would be a classic example of the church jumping on the wrong bandwagon just when the wheels were coming off. You know, so let's not do it. The other thing, the second thing is that knowing what I know about English the English establishment, the idea of unscrambling that would take a decade at least of tying up some of the best brains and a lot of money for lawyers and goodness knows what. And surely we've got better things to do with our time and our money than that. That's how I see it.
Well, thank you very much for being such an attentive audience and for all your questions. Shortly, we'll be going out that door, and there'll be refreshments, some wine, some apple juice or whatever around there. And do please make your way out of that door and enjoy some refreshments after the lecture. Now, we've had a tremendous evening tonight, and I would now like to ask the Vice Principal of the University, Professor Julian Jones, to come forward, please, and offer the vote of thanks. Thank you.
It is a rare thing, Professor Wright, to see this hall as full as it is this evening. In fact, the only occasions on which I normally stand at this lectern and see such a large and enthusiastic audience is when we hold our graduation ceremonies here. I'm not sure whether I feel a greater trepidation this evening as when I do then, because on those occasions, from time to time, I'm called upon to read out the names of the graduands. And your earlier remarks about the Gaelic language certainly come to mind. I never mind in the slightest names which are Chinese or African or even these polysyllabic ones from South America, because I'm fairly sure that only the graduand him or herself will know if I've got it wrong. But the Gaelic ones truly trouble me. Trouble me more, I suspect, than they would an Englishman, because you see, I'm the other sort of Celt. We P-Celts pride ourselves on having a language which is entirely phonetic. Oh, and by the way, in the Welsh language, the word for God is Dyw, D-U-W, which is nice and straightforward, isn't it? Now, there is at least one other man in the audience who will know this, and I'm speaking of our chaplain, Alistair Donald. He and I have something else in common, because on those days of graduation ceremonies, when we are here in our fancy dress, he and I are the ones wearing the same robes, because we are both PhDs from the University of Wales. I'm glad you said that some of my best friends are scientists, because that's what we are. You're a geologist and I'm a physicist. I hope you won't mind if I offer a few remarks which occurred to me as I was listening to you about some of the parallels in development in religious and scientific thought. You spoke of a confused world. I wonder whether, although that's undoubtedly true, it would have been equally valid to talk about a complex world. In my world of science, we started out, I guess, with Isaac Newton, who gave us the elegance of a clockwork universe, his law of gravity, a nice analytical approach, the ability to reduce, as you would have put it, to a set of equations. In fact, Albert Michelson at the beginning of the 20th century said that science has now reached the point that it will consist in determining the properties of materials in their fifth decimal place. How wrong he was. Soon it was 1905 and Albert Einstein and quantum mechanics. I think I'd rather attempt to lecture on quantum mechanics than what I'm about to say, but nevertheless, I'm not sure you would feel illuminated by it. And then, of course, as we've come closer and closer to the modern day, this appreciation that actually the universe is complex and there are certain matters which, except in terms of classification of behaviour, there is not an analytic solution. I'm not sure I agreed with you when you quoted that elegant expression that science has to do with taking things apart and religion about putting them together. You see, the hubris of the scientist is that we believe that in the end we shall put things together so we shall have the theory of everything. Unfortunately, we have a rather fundamental challenge at the moment in the sense that we're very good at the very small and the quantum mechanics, and we're quite good at the very big in terms of general relativity, but we don't seem to have the slightest idea what the one has in common with the other. It's somewhat more troublesome than that, too, because although we've reached the wonderful stage, particularly in this part of the world, of at least having some idea why things are heavy, and the Higgs boson and the Nobel Prize that went with it, and a fairly good zoo of subatomic particles these days, nevertheless, we find increasingly that the majority of the universe is made of something which doesn't seem to be these things at all, but is dark matter. And worse still, when we look at the apparent acceleration in the expansion of the universe, it's full of dark energy and we've no idea what that is either. Actually, this is a good thing. You said, by the way, that Downing Street doesn't do God, it doesn't do science either. It doesn't do these two things because they are hard. At the beginning of your lecture, I wondered whether I was going to enjoy it. You had a, and I enjoyed the the gentle ribbing of the Gallic language. And then you went for the easy targets, you know, the bankers' bonuses and the MPs' expenses. Now, oh, I could have done that. These are very easy targets. But, of course, that was just to soften us up a bit. Really, what you went on to say is that, actually, there aren't easy answers. The world is complex. It's just as complex, in fact it is more complex if you are thinking about the interactions of human beings as if you're thinking about the interactions of subatomic particles. And by the way, we physicists get nervous talking about anything bigger than a hydrogen atom, so the chances of contributing to the social context of the world are slim. Do you know, I'm beginning to get the feeling that I should remind myself, but not you, Tom, of a Welsh proverb. A dywedodd lleiaf hwnnw yw'r carllaf, which means he who is wisest says the least. Professor Wright, thank you very much indeed for doing the thing which I value most highly of all. Thank you for making us think.